Hey everybody, today's episode is sponsored by Penzu, your personal journal in the cloud. Penzu is where millions of people keep their most private thoughts, all locked with a secret password. Go to penzu.com, that's spelled P-E-N-Z-U now, and sign up for a free account. For extra security and fun customizations, go to penzu.com/GoPro on your computer and use promo code Radical for $5 off your Pro or Pro Plus subscription. Once again, that's promo code Radical. Now let's get to the show.
This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 22, and I'm glad you're here listening. Thank you. Before we get started with this episode, I would like to read something to you. So here we go. In the midst of a society tormented by war, racism, and social turmoil, therapy goes on with business as usual. In fact, therapists often look suspiciously at social change and label as disturbed those who press towards it. Concerned with maintaining and justifying current practices, therapy avoids moving towards making life more meaningful for all people. Now, I imagine you might be thinking that was written recently, but actually, it was written many years ago, approximately 1970, 71, and it was pulled from the Radical Therapist Journal. That journal was actually very influential to this podcast, obviously. That's where we got the name. But it was pulled from that journal. And the reason I read it, for two reasons, it's very applicable, obviously, for contemporary times, even though it was written many years ago. But also, we're going to meet these radical therapists. We have our first historian on the show, on the podcast, and I'm excited about that, Dr. Lucas Reichert. And he has written a lot about the history of radical psychiatry, and in particular, the radical caucus of the APA, the American Psychiatric Association. And he's going to take us back in time, and we get a chance to meet these radicals, self-identified radicals, and get really exposed to a lot of the important work they did at the time, and a look at this important journal and very influential journal. And so I'm really excited to talk to him and introduce you to these radicals as well. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Lucas Reichert. Dr. Lucas Reichert focuses on the social, scientific, and medical history of the United States and Canada during the 19th and 20th centuries. He is particularly interested in themes of gender and class as they relate to pharmaceuticals, recreational drugs, and public health. His research has often focused on the relationship among medical scientific research, health activists groups, and social justice in the medical marketplace. In 2014, he published a monograph called Conservatism, Consumer Choice, and the FDA during the Reagan Era, A Prescription for Scandal, which examined the politicization of pharmaceutical regulation in the 1970s and 1980s, and was awarded the 2015 British Association for American Studies Arthur Miller Center First Book Prize. A paperback version will be available, it's available now, in May of 2016. So Dr. Reichert has also worked with news agencies and websites, including CBC Radio, CBC News, CTV News, and Global News, as well as The Sheath, and Regina Leader Post, and the Saskatoon Star Phoenix. So without further ado, let's meet Dr. Reichert. All right, Lucas, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Chris. This is brilliant. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate that I, with your help, discovered your work, and because obviously it's very, I think you got how I named the podcast right away, I imagine, and where that came from. And I'm really excited that I get a chance to talk to you and you can kind of take us through the history of radical psychiatry how it started, and eventually towards the end, I'm going to kind of maybe get some impressions you have about activism in contemporary times. But before we get there, I'm wondering, can you give us a little, our audience a little bit about your background, how you kind of fell into researching activist groups, social justice, and kind of medical psychotherapy contexts?
Yeah, sure. I guess the first thing I would say is it's always wonderful when we historians actually get to communicate with mental health professionals. We always wonder, what's the value of what we're actually doing here? Sometimes we're kind of isolated in the ivory tower just talking to other historians. So, yeah, it's actually great to be able to communicate with people who are in the mental health service areas. So about my background, I don't want to plug my book right off the top of the podcast, but I wrote a book on the pharmaceutical industry in 2014 called A Prescription for Scandal. And part of that book had to do with HIV/AIDS activism in the United States in the 1980s. And it just really intrigued me how influential and powerful activists were in shaping discussions with the Food and Drug Administration, with the Reagan administration. And so in doing research on ACT UP and Project Inform, two of the most potent activist groups, I started to think about mental health activism as well. And a colleague of mine, Erica Dick, who's written on psychedelic psychiatry, she suggested that there were some records in Philadelphia on radicals. And so I hopped on a plane as quick as I possibly could after I scrounged together the money. Yeah. and went and checked them out.
And what did you find?
I found that the activist psychiatrists and the radical psychiatrists, as they called themselves, is not me putting some label on them. So I'm not designating them as radicals. They self-identified as radicals starting in 1967. And these are licensed MDs, practicing psychiatrists, who are operated in the American Psychiatric Association. Were pushing their colleagues, more mainstream, sometimes they call them establishment colleagues, to think about different kinds of ideas about, for example, the role of biological psychiatry, what kind of effects that would have on patients. They were pushing their colleagues on the value of social and community psychiatry, on the dangers of human experimentation. So in particular, Ewan Cameron's depatterning work at McGill University, they were pushing their colleagues to think about the bankrupt nature of insulin shock therapy and ECT and psychosurgeries. So these radicals were kind of driving a different agenda within the APA, and for me that was incredibly fascinating.
Right, and in your writing, maybe take us back a bit before the 60s. In your writing, you talk about, I guess, this kind of movement germinated in the 1950s, and with some subtle adjustments, and I'm wondering if you can kind of share about that and kind of the genesis of this whole movement.
Yeah, it's incredibly important in the 1950s. I mean, historians call them the long 1950s that stretch into the 60s. The radicals were drawing from thinkers like Eric Fromm and Jacques Lacan,
right,
who were using arguments about the sanity of society in general. patients' experiences, alienation in the United States, and you know, to in Canada as well, which is where I'm from. And so the radicals were drawing on these thinkers. They were also drawing on the notion of therapeutic changes, quite honestly, the rise of minor and major tranquilizers in mental health care. So the idea of whether or not we should be using major tranquilizers like Thorazine, and then at the same time minor tranquilizers like Miltown. So you have this pharmaceutical revolution in the 1950s, I guess a greater understanding of neuroscience and how we can adjust the brain, and so they're also engaging with these ideas.
And then I guess the next step, I'm going to maybe to ask you to talk about, you in your writing, I think you locate the bulk of the kind of the anti-psychiatry movement, you know, its genesis in the early 60s in the UK, and primarily around the work of R.D. Lang. And I'm not very knowledgeable about his work, but some of the work that I've seen of him, I'm just kind of a fascinating guy for his time. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about that. I mean, about him.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And you know what, Chris, I'm going to be moving to Glasgow in the next few months.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, I was hired at Strathclyde University.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah. And so anyway, this is the home of R.D. Lang, Glasgow. So R.D. Lang, yeah, his book, The Divided Self, which is published in 1960, it's one of the first critical evaluations of psychiatric orthodoxy. He wouldn't call himself an anti-psychiatrist. In fact, he rejected that term altogether. And that's a label that other people have put on him.
Okay.
It's kind of like Thomas Szasz as well, from State University of New York. In '61, he wrote The Myth of Mental Illness, and this is a book that built on R.D. Lang. And Szasz is asserting that mental illness was a metaphor.
Right.
And he said that psychiatry as a profession was more moral and political rather than based in hard science. But in the UK, R.D. Lang was incredibly influential. He was part of the Institute of Phenomenological Studies, along with Joe Burke and Leon Redler and David Cooper, and these guys together launched some of the earliest criticisms of psychiatry that then jumped the Atlantic and hit the United States, and then again as well in Canada here.
Yeah. So what happened next when it jumped the Atlantic? How did these movements begin to form? How did these movements begin to form both in Canada and America?
You had perhaps a new generation of MDs that were influenced not just by the work of Lang and Szasz and Irving Goffman and Michel Foucault and the other dudes I mentioned.
Yeah, right.
But they're also part of a social and political tumultuousness that's going on. So all sorts of historians have written about the 60s as this transformative era. Berkeley was at war, America was divided, it was an age of contradiction. So that's kind of the way in which I think of the radicals. They had these influences from the UK, but then there's all these massive civil rights and human rights changes that are going on in the United States and Canada. So some of the earliest radicals, like Paul Loewinger, who is this amazing kind of Einstein shock of white hair in pictures. It just kind of jumps a foot into the air. Just amazing kind of character. He's one of the founders of this radical caucus. And, you know, for his part, I mean, he was very much engaged in what was going on in the 1960s in the U.S. With civil rights in particular. So Paul Loewinger, he was a member of Physicians for Social Responsibility. He was a member of the Medical Committee for Human Rights. And these are organizations that both started in the early mid-1960s. Mm. He was part of the Mississippi Freedom March, and he participated by offering medical support during the Selma and Meredith marches. And he was influential in pushing some of his fellow radicals to think about engaging with the Black Panthers, a Puerto Rican group called the Young Lords. I hope I got that one right.
I think that's correct, yeah.
And at the same time in California with the Student Health Organization, which formed in at University of Southern California. So he's one of these guys who was very much on the ground, engaging with different groups, but then also working to try and change the psychiatry, the profession of psychiatry from the inside.
Yeah, and you talk about in your writing, I guess maybe two questions I have. You also mentioned that I think in 68 when the DSM was published, it kind of really divided the field. And then this radical, and that self-named radical caucus developed within the APA?
Right, okay. Yeah. So the APA, I've spoken to members of the APA who were there in the 1960s, like John Talbot. I was just at a conference in the UK, which is kind of the reason we had to push this excellent conversation back a little bit. I was at this conference in the UK where John Talbot, a former president of the APA, was there talking about the establishment members who were very much interested in social psychiatry, but maybe not so much interested in the notion of radical psychiatry. The DCM-2, it provoked a really significant discussion among psychiatrists. And this is because, well, for a variety of reasons, but from the radicals' perspective, it didn't elaborate classification schemes as well as it should have. And so there's this, and what the radicals said is that this was just a different form of mysticism, psychiatric mysticism and elitism.
Interesting. Yeah.
It kind of set the psychiatrist up as this guru that protects the knowledge and doesn't allow anyone else to share the knowledge. So it's an unequal kind of patient and healthcare provider relationship. This is one of the things that they're very unhappy with, right?
Which is still a critique today, really.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely it. So it's interesting that kind of critique has resonated from the 60s onwards.
Right.
And, you know, you have books written by E. Fuller Torrey, who's still practicing and still writing. And he says that psychiatrists in the 60s and in the early 70s were akin to witch doctors.
Wow. So did Talbot have a chance to talk about this radical group with you, or how they came to be, or what their, did they have some weight within the APA back then?
You know, that's a really good question about how much influence they really had. So just a bit of background on what some of them are, some of the actual actions that they took.
Sure.
So I mean, in 1968, they're in the APA meeting is in Boston. They first sort of get together and they release some pamphlets and they circulate them to their quote unquote establishment colleagues. They're not actually protesting yet anything, and then they're not very truculent, you know, they're not very aggressive. Mm. By 1969, they decide, this small group, Paul Loewinger, is at the forefront, as well as a few others. They decide to call themselves a radical caucus. They reach out to the Women's Caucus in the APA, as well as the Black Caucus and the APA, and they make common cause with them. Hmm. With the Women's Caucus, what they're trying to do is level gender differences, not only in the psychiatric profession, but also in American society more broadly. And then with the Black Caucus, the idea is to try and incentivize more African Americans to get into the field. And then in 69, what they're doing is they begin more protesting and are a bit more, I'm not sure if aggressive is the right word, but certainly challenging their colleagues to think about the, you know, coercive power of psychiatry in American society. And, you know, particularly how psychiatry legitimized the war in Vietnam, how it legitimized the war on drugs, which hadn't been named just yet. And then also how psychiatry created more alienation and more unrest in American society.
And also in your writing, you mentioned that in these early days, these groups, they struggled with a lack of solidarity. Could you say a little more about that?
Yeah. By 1970, there is, I guess, they begin to coalesce a little bit more. There is more unity. And from what I've found, it's really when they created their journal, the radical therapist, that you begin to see a bit more unity. So the radical therapist, it starts in 1970 under the aegis of Michael Glenn. He's a U.S. Air Force psychiatrist, and he's in Minot, North Dakota. And he said during the cold North Dakota winter, and something I can totally identify with being having lived in Saskatchewan for a while. Right. He wanted his publication to be a heated rallying ground to develop a therapy that served the people, and these are the words that he used. Rather than some other interests, whether or not it's the U.S. government or the APA, a therapy that actually served the people. Mm. So it operates from 70 to 72. Not a long time, Chris.
No,
you know,
yeah.
It's
was
it's
it like 12 issues or something like that too? Or something?
Yeah, you know, it's a grand total of 12 issues. So not a ton. The radical therapist changes his name after 72 and rebrands itself as Rough Times, which is it's also a great title.
Which will be my next podcast.
No. That's great. Yeah.
That is a great title, though, right?
Yeah.
We are in Rough Times.
Isn't it amazing? Yeah. With Donald Trump, but yeah. I don't want to make this about that.
Yeah, we'll save that one.
Okay, all right. So, I mean, John Talbot had a lot to say. So this former head of the American Psychiatric Association had a lot to say about these 12 issues.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I mean, not particularly grand in scope, 12 issues, right? But right. I think they're important, and he also thought they're important in his writing and in talking to him, because they captured essentially the scope, the breadth of the radical thoughts about this new type of therapy that actually served the people. So when you look through these 12 issues, and you know, it's a great red cover. I love it. Yeah. it's therapy means change, not adjustment. Yep. And so they wanted change for the medical model, which the medical model or the biomedical model, however you want to say it, as being a coercive or kind of oppressive tool. They wanted change for mental health service delivery. And here they kind of aligned with some of the community-based psychiatrists or those who are into social psychiatry. They wanted change to the repression of minority groups, whether or not as Puerto Ricans or African Americans or homosexuals. And so it's a really amazing window the radical therapist is into these ideas.
Right. And you can still get it, audience members, those of you who are listening. You can find used copies of the collection on Amazon and other places. So well worth your time. You also write, and I think this is really interesting because these are things that I didn't know actually, and I found it kind of fascinating. Your writings trace the beginning of like patient rights activism with groups like the Insane Liberation Front, and you kind of map their history. At the same time, these kind of groups are coming forward, and also what I found also really fascinating. You talk about how this radical caucus protested aversion therapy. I don't think it was named that back in 1970, but it seemed to me that you kind of tracked the beginning. Now it's being made illegal in various states in the United States. But you kind of trace the beginning of that battle back to this particular time and with the patients' rights activism. Can you say a little bit more about both of those?
Yeah, for sure. And I think it's super interesting too. That's why I got into history. So patients' activism, we now see it all over the place. We need to have better mental health care in the workplace. We have national mental health days all the time. And at the same time, we need to remove the stigma with mental health right. in society. And this is what the radicals were proposing in the Radical Therapist. Now they engaged like Claude Steiner, Hoagy Wyckoff, Joy Marcus, who is based in Berkeley. Had really vibrant debates about whether or not they should be working closely with ex-patients and patient activist groups. And so this is kind of a point of contention with the radicals, and ultimately kind of one of the issues that drove a wedge between them. And I need to do more work on this, but whether or not it helped splinter the radicals. Some felt that it was vital to work with the Insane Liberation Front, whereas others thought that it kind of undermined their authority to talk to their colleagues in the APA. So it's really intriguing to try and get to grips with that one. And so I guess I don't have like serious answers about this, but it is intriguing to me that that they were working so closely with the rise of these with patients groups. And you know, for your listeners, there are other scholars and writers out there who have done amazing work on the rise of patient activism. And Jeff Rayom, who's at York University in Canada, has got a whole list of publications. And he, for his part, and I'm not letting any secrets out that aren't already out there. It is a former patient himself. And so he's written quite a bit on the patient activism.
You'll have to connect us.
Okay. Yeah, sure. And no, I'm absolutely happy to do that. Yeah. And his work, totally kicks ass.
Yeah. Nice.
And can you remind me, Chris, what was that other question?
Yeah,
you
asked? Where in the annual meeting in 1970, you wrote about how the Radical Caucus protested aversion therapy. Really got critical about that practice back in 1970, and now we're just starting to see maybe the fruits of that labor, right?
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah, this is a wonderful anecdote and about the influence of the Radical Caucus. So in the annual meeting in 1970, the Radical Caucus was pushing against what they deemed abusive and violent therapies. And some of the violent therapies included Nathaniel McConaughey's work on treating homosexuality through what we would, you know, what we'd call aversive therapy now. Yeah. This absolutely enraged the radicals. And so they made common cause with some of the demonstrators who were at the meeting in Miami. So there's this wonderful story about how Nathaniel McConaughey, who wrote a book called Sexual Behavior Problems and Management, he was giving a paper at this conference about his clinical trials on gay men. And these clinical trials included, electric shocks and inducing nausea in his subjects. Essentially what he would be doing is he'd show homosexual imagery to his subjects, and if there was any sort of positive stimuli, then he would give them either a shock or he would induce nausea. The idea was he wanted to reveal the conditionability of homosexuality, right? Mm. And so the radicals who were at his paper, they insulted him, they interrupted him, they shouted things during his paper, including barbaric, gay is good, and essentially they called him a tool of fascist psychotherapy. And I'm not making this up, this is a direct quote. Right. For the radicals, I mean, his research was brutalistic, repressive, and just another example of the failure of orthodox mental health in the 1960s,
1970s. Wow, yeah, powerful. You brought up the work of Claude Steiner?
Well, I've said Steiner. I haven't had the opportunity to speak to him yet, okay. But I say Steiner.
Okay, I'm going to go with that too. So Dr. Steiner, okay. and his work at the Rapp Center in Berkeley. And he wrote something, the Radical Psychiatry Manifesto. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Rapp Center and maybe his work and that, the manifesto.
Mm, yeah. He's also one of the leaders of this movement, the Radical Psychiatry Movement and the Radical Caucus. Highly influential fellow, one of the key opinion leaders, one of the key writers. So he established a RAP center, which is Radical Approach to Psychiatry Center, in Berkeley in 1969. It was a free clinic, and he's written that they offered drug, welfare, Vietnam War draft counseling services. That they offered group psychotherapy as opposed to individual psychotherapy, and this was a way of connecting with feminist psychiatrists as well. I mean, he was also working with Hoagy Wyckoff and Joy Marcus. Joy Marcus was also a radical who was working in Berkeley at the time. So his Radical Psychiatry Manifesto Yeah, highly influential. He's using we talked a little bit about Lang and Zaz. Yeah. He's also drawing on work from Fanon, Franz Fanon, and Herbert Marcuse, as well as to a lesser extent Karl Marx.
Wow. Okay.
And so there's elements of socialism in there, and kind of the driving force for Steiner was that psychiatry was a full-on political activity, that psychiatrists, mental health providers were not in any way neutral. Neutrality was not an option. And for him, adopting neutrality in an oppressive situation meant psychiatrists were upholding unequal laws and outdated values in American society at the same time.
Yeah.
He and I mean, it's, he's a very interesting character, and also, I mean, kind of like Paul Loewinger, just an amazing looking character too.
Always nice when they have that look.
Yeah. Just a brilliant shock of hair again, you know, and he worked with Eric Byrne, who Eric Byrne was in McGill in Montreal for a long time.
Yeah, he did for the transactional Steiner, work. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know how much you want me to say about Steiner, but I mean, I would say that your listeners should find his work as well.
That's great.
And at least if they want a different perspective on the idea of individual versus group psychotherapy and paranoia in society. And nowadays, thinking about paranoia, especially with what's going on in Europe and the United States, it's, let's think about this.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so what happened? What happened to these movements? What happened to these people and these collectives and these journals? Are there traces of them still around? How have you tracked them?
Yeah, well, so they didn't. The Radical Caucus never went away, and so that's wonderful. So the APA continued to have Radical Caucus meetings every year.
Still to this day?
It's to this day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
To this day. It's ongoing. For these, the pioneers, they seem to make the case that the energy and the enthusiasm seemed to dwindle in the mid-1970s. That Paul Loewinger makes the case, the disillusionment and certain disenchantment in the 1970s kind of undercut any progress that the radicals would have. The radical therapist, as I said, turns into rough times, but it only lasts until the mid-1970s, and then they're no longer publishing. And so you don't have that forum any longer for these ideas. But at the same time, you know, I don't think it's a negative story. Instead, you get the rise of critical psychiatry. And there are some great authors out there like Carl Cohen, who's written about the rise of critical psychiatry. And then, of course, Jeff Rayom, who I already mentioned, he's done some excellent work in tracking the modern or more contemporary incarnations of these ideas that can be traced back to the radical therapist. So it's not a sad story. I think instead that these ideas have sort of been transformed and have a different bent somewhat.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. So now I'm going to ask you, maybe as a historian, kind of maybe try to get your view on some of the contemporary activism that's going on in mental health context. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm, you know, you mentioned there was a lot of critique back then by the Radical Caucus of the APA and its complicity in the Vietnam War. And I,
And I know APA is currently reeling from a torture scandal over these recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and working with the CIA, et cetera. And I guess as a historian, how do you look at these kinds of things, these contemporary things that are going on currently? I guess what's your take?
Yeah. So that's a really good question, Chris. I'm always leery about making predictions or thinking about the present. Historians are really bad at predicting the future. my sense is we're now, at least in history, and in the history of psychiatry, there's a full-on critique of the medico-industrial complex in popular literature. And in a lot of cases, I think for good reasons. So David Healy's scandal at the University of Toronto a number of years ago, he was fired for revealing information about Prozac's influence on suicide. Mm. Is just one example of the modern critique of the marriage between mental health and the pharmaceutical industry.
Sure.
Whether or not we're having far too many diagnoses. Some people call it diagnosis expansion
or inflation.
So I can't, when I read about these stories about high drug prices in Vanity Fair or in The Economist, I can't help but think about what Loewinger and Steiner were writing in the 1960s, where they were discussing about the oppressive power of psychiatry. But I'm also very skeptical of reflexive, unthinking criticism of mental health services.
Right.
And for those people who think that we just need to tear down the existing establishment and we need to strip the pharmaceutical industry of certain authorities, that's the Shkreli example too is another one that is very distasteful for people, where he jacked up prices something like 5,000% for one of his drugs.
Yep.
This goes a long way in undermining the legitimacy of genuine mental health service providers. So do I have like full-on answers for you? I guess as a historian, I'm pretty skeptical about offering prescriptions. Can I ask you, what's your take?
Yes. That's the first time I think I've ever been asked a question on this podcast. I think there's a lot to critique, but I also hope that there's more nuance in that critique moving forward. And but I think that you're going to see. I mean, there's an interest in activism again, I think, and you're seeing a growing. At least I am, and at least I'm in the circles I'm traveling in, a growing move towards maybe more activism in, at least in my world, it's in the therapy world, not so much the psychiatric world, but more people are becoming more interested in taking a critical stance and reviewing their own practices and trying to operate from a very ethical place. And I think that's all really great.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, and I hope to see more of it, and I hope this podcast helps people that are, you know, maybe isolated in some places to see that there's a lot of people that are, you know, talking about this stuff, thinking about this stuff, writing about this stuff, and just seeing how we could do a better job. I hope that helps.
Yeah, I already mentioned I just got back from a conference in the UK, and there were some very influential. Including Talbot, who were there, influential psychiatrists and mental health service providers who were talking about the future. How do we address stigma, mental health stigma in the UK, the United States and Canada? What kind of community-based psychiatry or mental health practices can be established in the future, whether or not it's built into schools? What kind of services can we offer to young people as well? And so I think that there's a dialogue that's going on. My soon-to-be colleague at Strathclyde University is Matt Smith, and he's written an amazing book on the rise of ADHD. And it traces traces this, and he's now writing a book on social psychiatry, and perhaps the return of social psychiatry in 2016 and afterwards.
Fascinating. Yeah. And I think as more of this, you know, writing gets out there, I think it can't help but transform the field, I would hope. So, one final question for you. What's up next for you? What are you thinking about these days? What are you planning to write about? What's caught your attention?
Well, in Canada, we're legalizing marijuana right away. Mm-hmm. And roughly a year or so, our new prime minister has, our yoga posing prime minister has promised. I don't know if you've seen these memes. And so what I've been doing is I've launched a new project on recreational drugs as legitimate medicines. And so the use of LSD as an adjunct in mental health services and was something that was going on in the 1950s, of course.
Yep.
But now the return of LSD in mental health care, as well as the use of medical marijuana in mental health care. Essentially trying to understand how mental health service providers can utilize different recreational drugs, whether or not it's LSD or MDMA or medical marijuana in everyday practice, how it was used in the past and now the comeback, if you will.
Yeah, and you are seeing a comeback.
Yeah. So that book is going to be coming out next year, hopefully, with McGill Queen's University Press. Great. It's called Contested Medicines.
Oh, wonderful. And we'll have to have you back on the show when it comes out.
Oh, please do, because this has been great.
Yeah. I really appreciate it, too. Before I let you go, really quick, if our audience wants to contact you or find you or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
I'm at Twitter at Dr. Lucas Rickert. And I believe I have a website that I neglect often called lucasrickert.com.
Okay, great. And I will have all of that in the show notes, audience. So you can just find the links there and the information there. And Dr. Rickert, I just want to say thank you for taking the time and chatting with us. And it's been a really great conversation. Thank you for taking me down the history of the radical therapist, and hopefully we can continue to carry the torch. So
thank you.
Yeah. Appreciate you having me on the show.
Anytime.
Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. Very much appreciate you, your attention and time. And as always, you can get a hold of me through email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. We're on the web, theradicaltherapist.com. We're on Instagram at theradicaltherapist and on Twitter at theradtherapist. And I would love feedback. I love hearing from you. I love getting sticker requests. As always, if you would like some Radical Therapist stickers, just shoot me a message via any one of those ways, and I will get them out to you right away. And we are continually getting requests all over the world, and I post pictures. If you go to our website, in the news section, you can see some of the other fans of the Radical Therapist podcast, and it's just really exciting to be able to do that. So my name is Chris Hoff. This has been the Radical Therapist podcast. Thanks for listening.